is some picks.
Hello, everybody. This is David Bixenspan here with the third episode of The Bix Show here on davidbix.com as well as voicesofwrestling.com. And today I got a very special guest, someone who had almost got to talk to a couple months ago, and I had been trying to figure out when I wanted to have him on. And I realized after I had Lance on last week that this week would be perfect since he's got something to promote, although he's got a few things coming up that we'll talk about. And that is the one and only Dangerous Doug Gilbert, a.k.a. the Dark Patriot, a.k.a. the Enforcer, a.k.a. one half of the Lethal Weapons. Am I missing anything?
Well, I'm sure you probably are, but I mean, if I ever need someone to hide, and I guess I got a bunch of different AKAs going.
So how are you doing today?
Man, I'm doing good. I'm on the way home from Florida. I was at the Brad Armstrong Memorial Show last night, and it was real good. Raised money for his daughter for her college fund and everything. Brad was a great guy. He taught me a lot in his business and everything, but yeah, everything's going good.
Yeah, so you were telling me before we started recording, I didn't realize that you go pretty far back with the Armstrongs, that I think you were mentioned that you worked with Brad a lot early on, and that also your dad helped train or did most of the training for Scott. So why don't you tell me a little bit about that?
Well, when my dad was in Pensacola, in the Pensacola territory, Scott was just starting, and Bob and Ron Fuller was actually booking territory, and I think Bob wanted to, his son to have a good guy to work with as far as that could actually wrestle with the, you know, I mean, I'm not saying these days aren't wrestling, but you know the difference in times have changed and everything, but to say wrestling and wrestler, and that's what my dad was, and a very good one. And he booked my dad against Scott for probably about 6 months straight every night, and I mean, which Scott and all his brothers and his dad too, I'll tell you, Scott will say that my dad basically trained him in front of people, which I mean, they worked out with him just like my dad and brother did with me before I got into the business and everything. But I mean, as far as in front of people, it's a different ball game and everything. And my dad taught Scott, basically about training him, I think, as far as in front of people.
Yeah, and you were telling me, so I guess that when you, so you were talking about that you worked with Brad a lot kind of around when you were starting out. So was that when you were in the UWF or?
That's when I was in UWF. When I left, when I graduated from high school, I went to Louisiana, and knock on wood, it was good for me anyway. My brother wound up being the booker there, and he wanted me to work in some of the best guys, the smoothest guys, and Brad Armstrong was one of the smoothest that they ever have been. And I would put like guys like him, like Brad, Bobby, my brother, different guys like that. You know, to me, that's like top notch as far as people. I mean, people that will push you and that are smooth, and you don't have to worry about anything. The only thing you have to worry about is them blowing you up in about 5 minutes if they want to, and everything. But I mean, as far as smooth workers, if everybody could be like those guys, we'd all have it made. And I worked with Brad. I was in a program with Brad, which they called Brad at that point. They had Crockett had sent him over there. It's when Crockett had just bought out the territory from Watts. And he sent Tim Warner and Brad Armstrong over there. And, you know, he called them the Lightning Express. I think that's what it was. And my brother put us in a program, me and Piz Wadley, against them for about 3 months or something like that. You know, I was in the ring with Brad every night. Like I said, Brad's one of the smoothest guys that's ever worked.
So I've been wondering, because at least I was looking up, and I'm trying to remember where it said it originally came from. That I saw something that said you started wrestling in 86, but the earliest I know of you is from that UWF run as the Enforcer in 87. So did you wrestle any matches either in Memphis or on Outlaw shows or anything before the UWF, or was your first match in the UWF?
Oh, yeah. Before that, I went to some place, kind of all the guys around here went to, which my dad, my brother, Wayne Ferris, Hobby Talk, all of them went over there. I mean, and there's a ton more, Larry Booker, Larry Knight, you know, Spots, Moondog. All of them went to Malden, Missouri. And it was a building, it was like a railroad track depot building. And if you went out of the ring, which you'd want to stay in the ring there, and how everybody likes to go out of the ring. If you went out of the ring, the floor was like, I wouldn't say it was just oil or whatever, but you know what I'm saying. It was like greasy oil type stuff. If you ever took a bump on it, you'd be black when you got up as far as on your skin and everything. It was a thing that you would stay in the ring. And in fact, it was, I mean, it was a decent-sized building. Right through. I mean, different. Like when they draw 100 to 200 people, and I mean, there was nobody there that anybody knew. You know, I mean, it was just all guys that was just starting. And I started over there when I was 17.
All right, so we had some technical difficulties there, but we were talking about UWF. So what do you recall about, like, when Crockett bought the territory and how you and Eddie found out?
When Crockett bought the territory, I mean, they had called Eddie and they flew. They had Eddie, which Crockett had bought him a home in Dallas and everything, and they had Eddie meet him out there and everything. But he wanted to actually, if he wanted him out there, he did live out there. He had him home out there and everything. And he wanted to run everything, his operations from out there. So we had a nice office building out there and everything. And but Crockett, he offered Watsonville that Watts couldn't turn down. And here's the deal, Dave. He bought out, right?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Do you remember that, right? He bought out Florida. Mm. He bought out, I was trying to think, it was three or four different territories he bought out. Like Watts was like the last.
Yeah, because he had done some stuff taking over for Bob Geigel, and then he took over, and then that kind of ended, but he took over Florida, and then he bought out Watts.
Right, and Watts. Well, now, tell me this, and I've heard people say that Crockett was such a smart guy. Now, if you was a smart guy, anything that, I mean, you know, the territories wasn't owned, why would you spend your money and buy territories when nobody owned? I mean, you owned the name of your territory, mm-hmm. but you didn't own that ground, that state, anything. Why would you do that for? And I mean, and that wound up being the deal why when he just freaking, basically lost everything, sold everything to Turner and everything because he freaking had spent all his money buying territories up. And I've never understood that. And a guy asked me one time who was business-wise, who did I think would probably be the worst business as far as money and stuff in wrestling. I said, Jim Crockett. And he said, well, why would you say that, Doug? I said, well, I would say that because why would you go buy territory? You never had to buy territory. You could just go into that town, that state, and run it. I mean, you see what I'm saying?
Right, especially by that point, you know, especially with what Vince had been doing for a few years and all that, right?
Exactly. That's my whole point. I mean, when you nationally, you're already on national TV, and it's like, why would you go buy territories for?
I mean, I think he wanted to get some of the TVs and stuff, but then he had to pay for the TVs anyway. So it didn't really make sense in the first place.
Right. Well, I'm saying business. I mean, you're a businessman. I'm a businessman. Why would a person do that? But I always said he is the, and I would not call anybody just stupid or dumb or nothing, but that's got to be, as far as business-wise, the worst, as far as in rest.
I'd like to take a moment to explain what you can do to support the Bick Show in one way or another. First, you can post a positive review on iTunes and or Stitcher. Simple enough, right? You can also choose to do your Amazon shopping via my affiliate links. This costs you nothing whatsoever, but a percentage of each purchase is kicked back to me for the referral. To do this, you can go to tinyurl.com/bixamazon Or you can go to davidbix.com and click my referral link, which can be found in the menu, sidebar, and show descriptions. Finally, if you want to speak directly with your wallet, there are two things you can do. The first is to become a patron on Patreon. That means that you choose to support the show with a monthly payment as low as $1. This type of continued commitment to me and my content really means a lot to me, personally, and I promise I will not let you down. If you want to become a patron, you can go to patreon.com/davidbix, or you can just click the relevant links at davidbix.com, which are in the menu, sidebar, and show descriptions. Alternatively, you can use the regular PayPal donation button on the sidebar of davidbix.com to send a one-time payment. If you want to pay me directly from your account, my PayPal email address is davidbix@gmail.com. With that out of the way, let's get back to the show. So something I was curious about you started, since it was your first full-time, wrestling job in the UWF as under the mask as the enforcer. Did you find that wrestling regularly under a mask so early, did you find that it made it harder to learn or made it easier because you had to catch up in terms of body language and stuff like that so quickly?
Well, actually, I think when you look as young as I did, that if you wear a mask and everything, that the people can see you as more of a, when you're going to be a heel and everything, that, they can't see that you're, such a kid and everything, if that makes any sense to you.
Right.
Everything, because when I come back to Tennessee, my dad and my brother, when I'd work in Nashville, they would be almost every Saturday night, somebody would try to slide in the ring, and I'd kick them right in the head when they'd come out of the ropes. My dad and my brother would have to watch because, it was just, when somebody looks so young and, is so young and everything, you're 18, 19 years old and, and you actually probably look younger than that. The guys, and then they get a little beer in them and everything, and they think they can beat everybody up, but they think they'd sure beat this kid up. So, you got a mask on, and I think it helps in your learning as far as your psychology and everything. Yeah. I think it helped me with that aspect.
Now, I was just thinking, as you mentioned Nashville specifically, it seems like whenever I hear stories about you or your brother getting, really heavy heat in the Memphis territory, it always seems like the stories about where fans started running in and there were almost riots or whatever in Nashville.
It was Nashville, but it was also Memphis. They hit the ring in Memphis. So, it depended on the heat, and this is what is so different from those days and these days. And we would go in the back, and Jared or Jerry Lawler, one would tell us what we. During the week, they would, it was programmed from Memphis to Louisville to Evansville or Lexington to Kentucky to Nashville on Saturday night. And we would know who we was going to wrestle. But what they would say were today, which they'll give you a script, what to read and everything. They would tell us, they'd say, this is what type match you're going to be in. And you've got, if me and Eddie was out together, they'd say you got 3 or 4 minutes for the interview and just, you sell tickets. What they were saying was you go out there and say what you think you need to say to sell tickets. And if you sold tickets, you didn't hear nothing but smiles. And if it didn't sell tickets, it didn't draw, then you knew that, it was all on you. There wasn't nobody else taking the blame. It was if you didn't draw money, it was on, and he was the top guys or right at the top guys, which my brother was always top guy, and I was always kind of right under him and everything. That was, that's how things have changed so much, which everything revolves and, that in life and everything, every business. But, I think the best promos and stuff was done where you could say what you could think about it yourself and say what you wanted.
Definitely going to agree with you on that. These days, it just seems so hard not just for someone to establish a personality, but sometimes I'll watch Raw and you'll see two guys and they have the exact same speech patterns, even though they have to, like...
Well, there's a reason for that. There's producers, and how could... And just say if it was me and you as the producers, how can you not get called up in when you're thinking about stuff, and you've got every guy that almost looks alike and everything, and you're doing the same, trying to tell them the same promos, you get caught in that. In the aspect of your mind is set in that thing. It's like I told someone the other day, they was asking me about things and what I watched and what I didn't. I flipped across and I've got Road Dogg. Burt James is my a good friend of mine and everything. And me and him was talking about it. And I mean, they've got some. I think they have got some real money guys and some good workers and everything. And I mean, like. You know, like in the old days, you had Bruiser Brody, you had Stan Hansen, you had, Nord the Barbarian, then you had, like, my dad, you had Jerry Lawler, you had Bill Dundee, you had Austin Ivel, you had Handsome Jimmy Valiant. Look at the difference between all those guys. All of them don't look the same. They all aren't jacked up. They all wasn't jacked up. They all didn't have... long bleached blonde hair or you know what I'm saying. I mean, everybody didn't look alike and everything, but now put yourself in a producer's shoes. Now, if you're sitting thinking 24 hours a day and your mind winds up getting to, I mean, I'm not saying a burnout stage, but you're thinking the same stuff and you're looking at the guys and they all look the same, well, then you're going to kind of go, I mean, not even thinking about it, go with the same stuff.
Yeah, and they're all coming through the same system, especially if they're newer guys. I mean, if it's someone that has more experience on the indies or whatever, they might have a little more of their own personality, but otherwise...
Right, exactly. That's like one of my all-time favorites, and I've booked him in Japan quite a few times, Terry Funk. I mean, look at Terry Funk. Look at Dory Funk. Now, that's night and day, and they're brothers. But what I'm saying is, look at them. I mean, they're not the same. I mean, look at Eddie and look at myself. We're not the same. What Eddie, my dad, always told me was, you can never imitate anybody, but you can take a little bit of what you see from one guy, a little bit from the other. If there's something that you do like, I mean, do your own stuff. But if you like something somebody does, it's all right to take a little bit, but change it a little bit and put your touch on it and everything and emulate. I mean, a little bit of what everybody, don't imitate nobody. And, you know, that's where I think I see people try to work just exactly like guys that they see on TV or call themselves the same names as guys that's on TV. And I think, Jesus, what's going on here?
Yeah, it makes me think of, it's not necessarily the best example these days, but, you know, like 10 years ago or maybe a little more, when especially up here in the Northeast, you had all these guys who tried to dress and wrestle exactly like Chris Benoit.
Exactly. Well, that's what I'm saying. So you see what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I mean, and I mean, just imitate. I mean, from 0 to 100, and that would be 100. I mean, it's the craziest thing. You emulate, just like I said, take a little bit here and there. Like, I love Terry Funk. He's always been great to me. I love Dick Murdoch. He was always good to me when I started. And I traveled with him a lot. I traveled with Terry a lot. I booked both of them in Japan quite a few times. I booked Dan Severn in Japan. I booked a lot of guys in Japan. And I've went to Japan myself, I think, 52 times or something like that and everything. But, I mean, getting to know guys like that, that was great workers and still are great workers, the ones that are still alive and everything. I mean, that's what I think taught me more. And I mean, my dad, anybody can say whatever they want. I think my dad's one of the most underrated wrestlers from his time. And my brother was 20 years ahead of his time as far as mind thinking, booking and everything, which anybody can say, well, he's just saying this because it's his dad and his brother. But I mean, a lot of guys in this business tell me that, the same thing what I'm telling you.
I mean, that is absolutely the truth. I mean, there are There are actually a bunch of things I want to say, kind of springing out of what you were just talking about. I mean, the first, just to kind of finish up the talk about the promos and stuff, Terry Funk is a great example, because I remember when King Curtis passed away, in one of the obituaries, I forget if it was The Observer or Slam Wrestling, Terry talked about how he tried to borrow from King Curtis on promos and kind of borrowed from his delivery. And at first, you don't really, it's not something you'd ever think about on its own. You wouldn't say, oh, he's copying King Curtis. But then you realize, okay, the way he takes his voice up and down and stuff, yeah, he did take that, but it's not a copy.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. Well, but I mean, he did it in his own way.
Right.
If you do stuff in your own way, I mean, that's one thing, but now to just freaking go out and try to be that person, and I mean, we see that. I see that down here down south, and I know you see it up north, like you said, they won't be Chris Benoit or whatever. But, I mean, that's just, you know, it make me scratch my head, which, I mean, I think the fans have got to think, you know, what is this guy doing? He just watched TV, and he's going to do the same thing that this other guy does, or he thinks he's him. But, I mean, you know, you take just a little bit. I mean, if you like what somebody else does, I mean, if you want to do everything on your own. But, I mean, I always tried to, when I was young, and then to the day, if I'm standing out at a show watching something, I'll watch different things. It was like I told Brian James, I flip across Raw. What gets me is, or SmackDown, whichever day that I flip across, if I see one of them and stop and watch and, you know, I hear it on social media. Everybody, I see so many people say, oh, it's awful and this and that. Well, if it's awful, why would you watch it for?
Right.
Why do you keep watching every Monday night and every Thursday night or Friday night, whatever it is? Why would you keep watching for? And they say, you know, it's awful. Well, you know what? They can say it's awful, but you know what? They have sold whatever it is over a million and something things of their TV stuff, so it ain't too awful, or that many people wouldn't be buying or subscribing to their network.
Right.
But like I said, and it's the people, the critics, that don't know what the wrestlers have to go through and everything. And look, and before I get off here, which we can talk as long as you want, but before I get off here, I want to tell you, anybody that wants to look at anything that I'm doing, you can look at it at DangerousDG1 for Twitter and Instagram and everything, and you'll see everything that I've got going on and everything, which is quite a bit, actually. And but, I mean, it's you know, you've watched, I've listened to you talk. I mean, you've watched the different shows and research stuff and everything. But like I said, the deal you're saying about people trying to be like Chris Benoit, I mean, why would one person want to be just like another person for?
Right. And then especially on indie shows, I feel like it almost just hurts everyone. It hurts everyone you're working with. It hurts the promotion, because then you're just looking like a ripoff of someone that's on TV.
Somebody emailed me a poster the other day. They had a fake Undertaker on there, a fake Kane on there, a fake The Rock on there, and I thought, geez, I think I have seen it all now.
Was it an American show, or was it from England?
Yes, I'm not. Well, I mean, actually, to be honest, I'm not sure. It could have been England, but I thought it was from the States.
Because in England, for some reason, I don't know if they do it anymore, but there were promotions that would do what they called WWE tribute shows, where they would have guys who would call, like, the British Undertaker or the British Rock.
I didn't see when the guy sent it to me. He just said, look at this. Is this awful? And I just glanced at it, at the poster, and I thought, this is something else. But, I mean, when you have... I mean, you know, like in Virginia, like you were saying, all my alias is the Dark Patriot. You know, there's a guy wrestling in Virginia, the Dark Patriot. So, I mean, you know what I'm saying? It's just, I mean, and I don't even, that don't even bother me. But what I'm saying, why does people even want to do that for?
Right. I mean, there are some.
I think you probably have answer like I do. Who knows, right?
Yeah. I mean, except that there are some cases, you know, where they're probably doing it kind of as a scam, because, you know, with the Patriot, with Del Wilkes' gimmick, a lot, you'll always see them billing themselves like as the original Patriot or the Patriot from the WWF or whatever. But I just, I never understood, like, if you're just doing it as, like, if you're not doing it as, like, if you're running a scam, you're running a scam, whatever. There's an obvious motivation for that. But just to.
It's like I said, like, that James C.G. one on my Twitter and Instagram. Now, you don't think my stuff don't start blowing up when posters start getting put out that says the Dark Patriot or whatever, any of the aliases that I've wrestled under? My Twitter starts blowing up saying, are you going to be there? Are you going to be there? We're going to come. And I think, and you know, I got to say, well, no, I'm not going to be there. And I want everybody to make money. Don't get me wrong. I mean, I want everybody. I'd like for every promotion to make money that they're actually wrestlers like they used to be, but there's not a whole lot, Dave, of wrestlers like they used to be.
Yeah. Now, as far as wrestlers like there used to be, though, you were talking about your dad and just how underrated he was. I mean, that was something I definitely want to talk to you about anyway, that he was just so, he was so versatile. I mean, that's the first word that comes to mind when I think of your dad, that he could be, you know, he could be kind of this kind of Burt Reynolds-ish baby face, or he could be this kind of grizzled veteran heel, or he could be Nightmare Freddy and be a kid's character under a mask, or he could be Mr. Wrestling or Ace of Spades, or all these different, not just different characters, but very different wrestling styles.
Oh, yeah, which is he told me once that when I was about 14 or something, which he knew I wasn't going to do nothing else but wrestle, that he would say wrestle until I got started, and he did. Then he went on a few years after that. But anyway, my dad, he was so smooth. And this is one thing I don't think everybody knows about him. When they'd bring Lou Thesz into Memphis, Lou Thesz wouldn't wrestle Lawler or any of the other guys. Lou Thesz would wrestle my dad. My dad was, a wrestler. It's like I told people before, I said, when your dad's Tommy Gilbert and your brother's Hot Stuff Eddie Gilbert, I said, it's not bad to be the third best out of the family. I said, because my dad was great, my brother's great. And everything. So, and like I said, when they'd bring in Nelson Royal, which was the NWA Junior Heavyweight Champion for years and everything, who would he wrestle? He would wrestle my dad. My dad was the wrestler, the wrestling guy too many people want to wrestle Lou Thesz because they knew if he wanted to do something to him, he'd do it. And everything, him and my dad always had great chemistry and everything. And he liked my dad. Lou liked my dad because my dad was a wrestler.
Now,
before my dad got out of before he got out of his wrestling school, he done had two cauliflower ears. So see, if something like that would have happened today, they'd try to get him for about attempted murder or something, probably, right?
Something like that. Now, when did you, about when did your dad start wrestling? Because I was trying to figure it out, because it was when I was researching the article for Fighting Spirit about Eddie, and I was trying to...
69.
You know, I was like 69. So he started later than some wrestlers would, especially these days.
Oh, yeah. He was, age-wise, he was 27, I think, something like that.
It says 1940, so he was like 29, 30, maybe almost 30.
Yeah, something like that, 28, 29, something like that.
Yeah, it was actually right around you so it's not long after you were born then.
Or was it before? It was right when I was being born, at that point.
Yeah, so... Yeah, because I remember I was trying to figure it out because I was there was something I read. Oh, it was that article. I had found this old magazine article about Eddie, like right before Eddie broke in or something, talking about like how he had to deal with it at school because it was like right because of it was like how things changing when your dad started wrestling. So anyway, with all this, I was also curious about your grandfather, because I didn't know until recently that you were a third generation wrestler. What can you tell me about Arlie Gilbert?
He was actually the first one, and I mean from the fair days, from the wrestling, you know, from the
right carnival wrestling,
from the carnival days, like, I mean, and everything. And that's what you know, he started as far as doing that, and whether, you know, they challenge anybody, you know, out of the crowd and everything else. And, I mean, my granddaddy's was a tough son. Yeah.
So did he only do the carnival wrestling, or did he, like, later on do what we would consider more of a modern type pro wrestling?
No. He done the, like, the challenge out of the crowd. He didn't do any of the actual, like we do as far as what we call pro wrestling.
Right. Yeah, because that's
what got my dad so intrigued with it and everything. And then, my dad, my granddad worked on the pipeline, and then my dad worked with him on the pipeline until he got into the wrestling business.
That's interesting. Yeah, I don't know. I guess because it was never pushed that much on TV, except maybe someone told me maybe around when Eddie started that. I just don't remember you and Eddie ever really being pushed as third-generation wrestlers, so it never clicked with me until I read something about it. Like, I don't know, maybe a few months before I wrote the article? I didn't know, because like, the only ones I knew of, like, because I didn't even think before you and Eddie, I'm not sure, other than maybe the Fullers, who else there would have been as far as third-generation wrestlers.
Right, which is funny you say that, because Roy Lee Welch was at the show last night, at Armstrong Memorial Show.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, you're talking about Fullers, which that's Fullers and Welches, and they're all the same.
Yeah.
And everything. But anyway, now we all are, and that's one thing for sure.
So, and one of the things you mentioned, you know, talking about how Eddie was 20 years ahead of his time and his thinking, and how people, you know, some people might think that he's just saying because he's brother, blah, blah, blah. But one thing that it was Terry Sims told me about this, and then I think I heard Joe Pedicino talking about it on Terry Sims' show, and Terry told me to ask you about it, that Eddie was actually getting feedback online and going on like places like CompuServe, like when he was booking Global that long ago, like almost 25 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and right here's the funniest thing is, because all the guys said, you don't do interviews with people, and you don't do like what now they call shoot interviews and everything, and you don't talk to people with the sheets and this and that and everything. And Eddie just pretty much basically talked about the business, about what his philosophy was, and he would ask ideas he had his own ideas, but what if somebody else, what they might like or whatever. And, you know, everybody back then said, you don't do that. We control this business and everything. But see, now, today, who does shoot interviews? Everybody, right?
Right.
You know who did the first ever shoot interview?
Eddie, with Bob Barnett.
Exactly. And it's a funny thing. And I was going to do one with Bob, and Rob Feinstein called me, and me and my wife's going to New York, and I just went ahead and did it with him and everything. But yeah, the first one that was ever done was with, and everybody said, nobody should ever do that and everything, and everybody's done one now, right?
Right.
So tell me what's right and what's wrong.
Now it's just part of the deal. When they have conventions, you know, it's just whoever hasn't done a shoot interview yet, or if they have a new idea for them, that's when everyone does their shoot interviews, is at the convention.
Right here's the thing. If they don't ask you to do a shoot interview, you hadn't been involved in nothing for anybody to want to listen or to buy one. That's the only reason that you wouldn't be asked to do one.
Yeah.
But I mean, back in those days, they said, this will never be done. But now, if anybody gets a chance, they do one.
So I guess since your dad was old school, I mean, what did he think of the way that Eddie and you were kind of were more open, whether with newsletters or going online or doing radio show interviews. Was he on board with that, or did he not like it at first?
Well, he didn't. He knew Eddie was ahead of his time. Now, I wouldn't say he liked it, but it was one of those things that everything was. You know, I mean the worst thing. I mean, everybody says. And to this day, somebody say, "Well, I'm going to expose the business." Now, the worst kept secret in the world is expose the business, right? I mean, how are you going to expose the business? I mean, Frick Vince said it's entertainment. I mean, how do you expose a business like ours that's been tried to be exposed a million times and people are still trying to do it to profit off of? I mean, I don't understand that point. But no, in all reality, my dad. He never said nothing to Eddie, but he didn't like it too much. But it was one of those things which I think he like I'm telling you now, that Eddie was so far ahead of his time that it was unbelievable.
He knew the business was changing.
Right. Yeah. And you had to change with it. It's like whatever you get up and go do tomorrow at work, or if you run your own company or whatever, and a month and 2 weeks and a month next year, you've got to change with it or you're going to be left behind.
Right. Now, some of my very favorite stuff to watch is after the UWF, when you and Eddie went back to Memphis and were teaming with your dad, and Eddie was still with Missy then, and she was on TV, and she would even bring her niece on TV, and it was the whole Gilbert family taking over. I mean, that stuff to me is just some of the most fun wrestling to watch. I mean, what was that like for you to be a part of? Because just for me, it was just there was so much stuff, whether it was the stuff with Lawler or so much of the stuff was funny, like, but in the way that Memphis could be funny, which is different from the way WWE tries to be funny. It just, I love that stuff. I mean, what do you remember about that period?
I love that whole period. And I mean, I used to never watch YouTube, and guy got telling me that he was watching some about a year and a half ago. I said, "Do what?" And he got telling me, and I couldn't even remember what exactly he was talking about, which he was talking about angles that we did somebody. And I said, "Shoot, I don't even remember that. Let me look." So yeah, so I've never even watched anything. And I got on there and got to watching, and my wife wound up coming in saying, "You've been on that computer for an hour and a half. What are you doing?" Because it's not like me to stay on the computer for an hour and a half just watching something. And I just went from what I started out watching to, you know, it keeps showing different things of our stuff. And I just kept watching. And I thought, man, that's when things really, when I thought things were really good and everything. The only thing that could have been better about it is if Eddie would have chose a different life than Missy. That would have been the only thing that could have been better about the Memphis TVs at that time.
I thought her character I liked her character then, though.
Well, yeah, but we could have had a character that we all liked as far as the family.
Well, yeah.
That's my point. But right. Anyway, but no, actually, all the my brother's wives that he had, Medusa was my favorite as far as everything. I mean, she was real cool and everything.
So did you, I mean, I know you were involved in terms of booking wrestlers into Japan, but how much of an interest did you have in, like, the creative side of booking?
Well, I have, as far as, I would go to the office, like when we was around Tokyo and everything, mm-hmm. I would go to the office every day, and we would sit and talk and everything, and I knew I'd got to where I'd been there a little too long when I could start, and by no means can I speak Japanese fully, but when I started being able to understand a lot of what they said, I knew it was time for me to go home and everything. But, you know, back in those days, we'd stay 36, 37 days at a time. Yeah. And you know, you was ready to go home by then because you was fighting for your life about every night, every other night. We'd wrestle at least, it was usually 5 nights a week, if not 5, at least 4. And everything. And it was just, I mean, I had, they would ask me what my thoughts on things was, and I would tell them what my thoughts was, and then, you know, I knew who the top Japanese guys was, and we had to keep them over, but we had to keep the gaijins over also to draw money for the shows.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and it was the same as far as the logic. I mean, it was so different as far as because you're going 100 miles an hour over there, which, I mean, these days now in the States, they're doing the same, but you're going 100 miles an hour, and you're doing every finish in the world and dropping everybody on their head and their, whatever you can drop them on and everything. And, I mean, pulling your knees up to your back and everything. And but, I mean, I had a good owner and everything. And Sino was owner of IWA, who I booked for and everything. And, I mean, he was real good to me.
When was it that you were working backstage for IW? Was it like, what was, was it like 2001 or about then?
It was, yeah.
Okay, because I was a fan of that stuff. I really enjoyed when I could get tapes. I could get tapes of it, because
I'm going to tell you what I really enjoyed was being over there and having Terry Funk over there with me. Hmm. Having Dick Murdoch over there with me, having Bill Eady over there with me, guys that if you, Terry Gordy over there with me, and I mean, like, guys in the States probably won't know, but Tiger Jet Senior had him over there with me, and I mean, guys that was like, I mean, and I don't even like to say this, but got like godly type figures over there to the people.
Right.
I mean, Dick Slater, which I had him over there with me, and I worked against him quite a few times, which now he was a character, which everyone I said was a character. But, I mean, and look, at every name I just said now, every one of them are different, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was just talking earlier about how everybody's the same, and when you say the interviews, they're the same and everything. But now look at all them guys, and look at the promos that all of them could cut, and everything is different. Everybody is their own character, and I mean, I see why WWE did the Performance Center. They want to bring their own talent and everything, and I understand why they're doing it from a business point. So they will always have their guys, and they'll know who's coming up and everything. But I mean, and which, like I said, everything changes and revolves and everything. But I mean, it's just hard to grow up like I did, and like you're saying, what you watched and everything, and then see things change so much.
Well, you were even around sort of for the beginning of WWE developmental, because the first promotion USWA, I mean, because it wasn't officially, but yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm going to tell you, Dwayne Johnson, Kurt Angle, trying to think which other ones come through here at the time that we wrestled.
Every other night.
But they come through here, and I mean, you know, I mean, before it wasn't developmental then, but you know, I mean, you know, Steve Austin come through here,
right?
And before he went to WCW, then went on to Vince. I mean, everybody. The only ones that didn't come through here was the kind of the Canadian guys, and I mean, as far as when you're talking about the developmental deal, a few of them did. The guy, and I can't remember what his name was. He was a hockey player, and he was a big guy, and then one of them was some kind of ultimate fighter-like dude. And
Glenn Kolka and Mick. Are you talking about Glenn Kolka and Mick Tierney?
And Bruce Pritchard came to TV one day, and he said, "Doug, but you know, I mean, Bruce was my manager at GWF,
yep,
and everything too." And he came to TV one day, and he said, "Doug," he says, "y'all, how's the guys doing?" I said, "They're doing good." I said, "We're the ones that aren't doing so good." He said, "What do you mean?" I said, "Well, we're trying to help, or we're helping teach y'all's guys how to work." I said, and I mean, and all right, and I want everybody to make money. I mean, I want them to make money. I said, "Are y'all supposed to pay us?" And he said, "Well, don't Jerry Jarrett pay y'all?" I said, "Well, yeah, Jerry Jarrett pays us." I said, "But we're training guys for y'all." And he said, "You know what?" He said, "That's right. Let me get back to you. You know, when I've heard anything back from him, still not to this day. but anyway, it's cool though, because I mean, I got to know Kurt Angle, and he was real cool then, which I guess he is now. I hadn't seen him in years. And Dwayne Johnson, he was cool then, and I'm sure he is now. I know he's got a book of money from all the movies that he's done and everything. But it's cool to help guys. I mean, I think when you help people, at some point it'll come back around.
Yeah, it's just so different now too, because I mean, especially towards that end there, because it was the last full time territory.
Right, David. See, but then, like Dwayne Johnson and Kurt Angle, they told them to go out on TV. They didn't have no scripts or nothing. They told them what kind of match they was in, and then told them, you know, you just say, and they'd give them like a clue kind of what to say, but then they had to say it. And, you know, that's how you learn how to be yourself and your own character.
Yeah, yep. And, I mean, I just think back, and I think, in Memphis, too, it was an environment where, you know, if someone did kind of mess up, like I think back to, you know, I just talked to Lance Russell about this on the show we had last week, where, especially when Lance was around, he was a guy who could even kind of carry people through promos as an announcer,
yeah,
and then even help them after, just as the announcer.
And it's funny you're saying that. Oh, that's, I mean, I was with Lance last night and everything. I laughed. One of the guys come up and said, I want a picture or two of the legends. And I said, Pop, which my dad was there with me, I said, Pop, get up there with Lance. And he got up and stood with Lance. They took four or five pictures. And I said, well, when y'all get done taking me with the legends, I want to get in here on the other side of Lance. I want my picture took with the legends also and everything. But Lance is great. And like you said, Lance could carry anything. And when somebody had asked me about talk about Lance as far as what else did he do other than wrestling, as far as like a living, I said he made a freaking living out of wrestling. He was so good.
Yeah, and there is no one, not just in wrestling, there is almost pretty much no one on earth like Lance Russell.
No, I mean, Lance is my favorite. And Lance, his son told me last night, he's 89 years old, he'll turn 90 next year, and he said that they're going to all the different events like Cauliflower Alley Club next year, and if you'll be with me, that's a good thing at PopCon that's coming up Friday and Saturday. And
yep.
I mean, I love to hang out with Lance. He's my favorite since I was a kid. I mean, he is the voice of wrestling for us down here in the South.
Yeah, and for me, like I didn't grow up on Memphis wrestling up here in New York, so I might have seen it a little bit when it was on cable, like right before he went to WCW, and then when he was in WCW, he always, something about him stuck out to me. And then once I got into tapes and everything, I mean, he is the greatest wrestling announcer of all time. Just as good as Gordon Solie was, as good as Jim Ross is and was, I just feel like that there were so many different things he could do, especially because in Memphis there were so many different things that could happen. He could call a straight technical match. He could get every angle over. He could save an interview. He could carry an angle. I mean, just everything. And he had so much credibility.
Well, it's like you said. I mean, they could be a guy out there that could not speak two straight words, and Lance would get him through an interview and get the points over and get him across. There's not no guys in the world that can do that. I mean, Lance was great at what he did. I mean, he was the best. I mean, like I said, you could get a guy out there, I think you could get a guy that would stutter and couldn't say, you couldn't understand what he said, Lance would get him over and everything. But I mean, Lance was great at his job.
Yeah, and I also feel like maybe now he does, but I feel like for a long time, Dave Brown didn't get enough credit just because he was sitting next to Lance Russell.
Well, I think so too, but I told, and I've said this on, somebody called me the other day and was asking me, and I did a little interview with him, and I told him that Dave's great too, and I mean, Dave is, and I just saw him at one of the lottery years I didn't see him, and they had I forget what they called the show, it was like a reunion or something, it was me against Lawler in the main event in Memphis here, I don't know, like No, actually, it was the anniversary of when he had his heart attack, was what it was, the show. They had a show then for that, which I thought, now this is a strange anniversary to have a show on. But anyway, that's nor here nor there. But anyway, they had me against Lawler in the main event, and nobody else I knew on the card, and Lance and Dave as doing the commentary for mine and Lawler's match. And that just gave me cold, I mean, chill bumps. Just, I mean, it was back like when we was in the Mid-South Coliseum. And, I mean, Lance sounded exactly the same, and Dave sounded exactly the same.
Yeah. One thing that I definitely want to make sure I ask you about, because this was something that I did grow up on, was that, you know, for years here on, you know, on, like, the local sports channel, that we always got the Savoldi's ICW. And that was, I guess, the first place that you kind of went on your own, right?
Right.
Right. So, because you were teaming with Dennis Condrey as the Lethal Weapon. Yeah, as the Lethal Weapons, with Paul Heyman as your manager.
And you could not have no better partner. Dennis was a great worker, still is a great worker, and a great guy. I mean, anybody can say whatever they want, but all my dealings with Dennis is, I mean, if you ever had a problem, Dennis had you back. You didn't have to worry about looking at somebody being gone. And Dennis was a double tough son of a gun.
So, I guess, was there... So, I guess, what was it like for you, I guess, because that was the first time you were kind of away, wrestling away from Eddie and your dad. I mean, right. I guess you had known Paul Heyman for a little while, but you were wrestling in the Northeast, so kind of an unfamiliar area. I mean,
it was good. I think I needed that.
Yeah.
I needed to be away and needed to be on my own, and it was time for me to be on my own, and thank goodness I had a good person to be with Dennis. Mm-hmm. And like I said, as far as if you wanted a guy to get a heat, we had the perfect guy as our manager, because anything that he says, just the way it comes out, I don't care where he's at. I mean, it's going to get heat. It's Paul Heyman. But, I mean, Dennis, like I said, if you can't work with Dennis, you can't work with nobody. I mean, Dennis was smooth, and like I said, still is smooth work when he wants to work.
So, I guess, you and your brother both were such big, because I guess, a lot of people, of course, would be fans before going into wrestling, but you were a pretty huge fan, you know, whether it was, with the newsletters and the WFIA conventions and stuff. Were you a big Midnight Express fan before you teamed with him?
Oh, yeah, I loved, and like I said, I always thought him and Bobby was two of the smoothest workers that they was. I mean, Bobby was always, I mean, all those guys like Ricky Morton, Robert Gibson, Bobby Eaton, Dennis, all them guys treated me like their son. I mean, I was, the little kid. I went with my dad to Mid-South Coliseum since I was 5 years old, on every Monday night and everything. And, I mean, I got to know everybody. Whatever they wanted, they'd give me money. If they wanted something to drink or eat, they'd give me some money. Tell me to and give me extra money. Tell me to buy me whatever they bought them and everything. And I got to know everybody so good. But I mean, it's like I was like their little boy or their son or their brother or something like that.
So of course I have to ask you about. There's a couple things I absolutely have to ask you about. When Eddie ran over Lawler with the car on Memphis TV. Now, I believe your role, because you were part of that angle, and also I believe you were the one who procured the car from Brian Lee.
Right.
So what exactly happened there? Because I know there's kind of a story to that.
What happened there was before this all, I was trying to figure out, because the angle had been going on so long with Eddie and Lawler, what to do next.
Mm-hmm.
So me and Eddie was sitting one night at the house, and like I said, Eddie was wrestling 24/7, and I mean, I love the business and everything, but I like to talk about other things and do other things, and where Eddie basically he would do other things, but I mean, we'd be right in the middle of doing other things, he'd say, hey, this is Angle, and I thought, dude, he ain't gonna think about nothing but this, so he said, what have we got left to I could do to Lawler. And He said, what if I run over him? I said, run over him? He said, yeah, what if we run over him with a car? I said, well, that's one thing that had never been done. And I guess you could shoot him. And he started laughing. I started laughing. He said, no, I think it'd take him too long to get well if I shot him. And so we did the deal. We run over him with the car. After all said and done, we hit him about 25 or 30 miles an hour, hit him way too fast. And this was something that, and I mean, I always say Lawler's a double tough guy. I mean, now who would, a car coming at you, you know, a car's going to be coming at you, but I mean, I don't think he thought it was going to be coming that fast, and it wasn't meant to be coming that fast, but by the time it got to him, it was. And I mean, I think his intent was to jump up and it not hit him. Well, he didn't, well, he was going so fast. When it hit him, it knocked him straight. He flew right into the windshield and flew straight. If you've ever watched this on YouTube or anything, just spun around in the air. But I mean, when his whole body, his butt, his back, everything, his head, the indention was in the windshield. And all of a sudden, after he stuck there for a second, he just flew off the top. And he started just spinning around like 360 and then landed. And when he was flipping around in the air, I looked out of the passenger side and was looking back at him. And Eddie was still, I think he was kind of in shock. And we almost run straight into a wall, a brick wall at the TV station. And at the last minute, he turned. And we missed it. And he asked me, he said, well, what do you think? I said, I think you killed him. And he said, no, you don't do it. I said, yes. I said, I think he is hurt bad. And so we pull around a couple blocks, and I walk back to the TV station and walk in the back, and they finally got him from the parking lot inside, and he's laying on the floor, and he's moaning. And it had knocked his hip out of socket. And right here is the whole deal. He can't hardly walk or nothing. The TV station comes back and tells them there have been so many calls to the police station and 911 calls and just calls to the police, and they called the police and said it's been a hit and run. So when all the cops come over there, the police, the guys over the station come back and tell Lawler and Jared, which I don't even think Jarrett was there that day, tell Lawler that if he don't go out on TV before the show's over, that they will lose the TV. Whew. So now he's laying with his hip out of socket on the floor. Now, can you imagine that? Imagine what pain that is. Yeah. Like I said, he's double tough son of a gun, and I went in and I asked him, was he all right? And he said, yeah. And I thought, yeah, you know, you ain't all right. You're laying on the floor just in agony. So they got him to his feet, and he hobbled out there. And the whole deal was he was going to be off for like a month. I mean, he wasn't going to work for like a month and everything. But because the deal with the TV with the police and everything, he had to get up and go back out there and not do the thing was he was going to be off a month, and then he was going to work with, they was going to bring different guys in. But because the deal went, I mean, see, people don't even know that. And everything. I don't even think I've ever said that to anybody. I said he hurt his leg and his hip and stuff. But, I mean, that's the reason he had to go back out and everything. But, I mean, they've been had plans for, like, Eddie to work against three or four different guys the next four Monday nights. And then Lawler come back and then beat the big, and then it would have drawn. But with them saying that about losing the TV and everything, he had to go back out. And then his hip was messed up. So after he went back out and did the promo about us running over him, he went to the hospital because he had to get his hip fixed. Well, when they started asking questions about what happened, he told them. And when he told them, they called the police. Well, then when the police come to the hospital, they wrote a report, and then they come to Mid-South Coliseum Monday. So when me and Eddie got to Mid-South Coliseum, they was there to arrest us. And so then that's when Lawler had to say, look, guys, I knew this was going to happen. And believe me, that's something he never wanted to have to say.
Wow. I don't think I ever knew that it got to that point. I knew about him, why he had to go on TV and stuff. I didn't know that it actually got to the point where the police came back at the Coliseum. Wow.
Oh yeah. They come, and the only reason, and this is what I told Eddie after they left the Coliseum and the police left. I said, you know what would happen? I said, if it would have been something awful bad happened, I said, we would be going to prison because they would not be nobody there to say. I mean, he would have been the one to have to say that he knew what was going on.
Right.
That's when I thought, Jesus. And then after that, me and him talked about it, and he said he might have been better off if we did shoot him. And I said, which, because you know, whole deal about shooting the funny things, who shot JR, and you know, the Dallas show and everything. And that's why I said, well, I'm not really shoot him. Ain't nobody shot him. And everything. And he said afterwards, he said, I'd have probably been better off if y'all would have shot me. But anyway, it was a heck of a deal. Like I said, when you get back to the Coliseum and then they're there to arrest you, it's, you know, make you scratch your head. Wish you hadn't come back to Coliseum. But, I mean, that day they was already at the TV station going to arrest us there. And when I saw Lawler down, I went out the back door and went back two blocks to the car where Eddie was at. We got out of Shelby County, got out of Memphis, because we would have went to jail that day.
Wow. So, so the other things I wanted to make sure I want to ask you about. So, Global, I guess, was... As the Dark Patriot was the, I guess, your first time being, like, the singular top heel. And
yeah, it was.
And you, so first you're feuding with the Patriot, and then eventually you got to work with Eddie. And now I'm trying to remember, did you cut promos at first, and then eventually it was Bruce Pritchard cutting promos for you, or did you not speak the whole time?
I didn't speak. I wound up saying just a couple words, just... very, very few words. Bruce Pritchard did most of the talking. Well, at first, before Bruce got there, the first couple weeks or so, I did my own promos. And then as quick as Bruce got there, like I might say one or two words.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, Bruce was great as far as promos and stuff. I mean, people sent me stuff, and I mean, I hadn't watched or seen it in so long and everything. I forgot about it. I mean, Bruce was really great doing promos.
Yeah, I hadn't watched a lot of that in a long time until recently either, and I had forgotten just how good he was in that during that run as himself. I mean, I
it's like I say, you go back then, you know, him and Eddie would talk, and Eddie would say, Bruce, this is what we want, just get this, but sell tickets, just hit this point. All we will do is draw money, just hit these points, and what you think will draw us money, and that's what Bruce did. But, I mean, Bruce was really good, I mean, as far as how that went.
And what did
he... And, I mean, and he had the look also and everything. I mean, he looked the part and everything. I liked that time and Global and everything. I had a good time. And like I said, I worked with, I worked with the guys before the lead up to work with Dale, but then I worked with Terry Sims, Terry Garvin, and then I worked with our brother a few times. And you know what? Terry Funk told me one time, and I thought, well, that's strange. He said, and this is before I'd ever worked against Eddie. And he's, Sonny, he said, after that, they booked me against my brother over here in Japan. He says, and I think, which, I mean, it's probably different aspects of it, but I think his brother's working against brother. But I'm going to tell you, Eddie was in so good a shape that, you're talking about pushing you. I thought I'd come back from the ring, and I'd be trying to get, when I'd got up the aisle way up the sportatorium, which you're walking up an incline the whole way after you get out of the ring, after I'd get out and the camera wasn't on me, I'd start trying to untie that mask because I thought I was going to freaking smother, because I mean, Eddie would push you and push you and push you, but that's what he wanted to do. And I mean, he wanted to do it to me, and he'd do it to everybody, but he wanted everybody to be better. And I mean, that's what everybody should want.
Yeah, and as much as he does get credit for his booking and his promos and everything, I do think he's still kind of underrated as far as his in-ring work.
Oh, I think so. I mean, I've seen him go 40 and 50 minutes a night on an every-night basis for months in a row. And, I mean, when other guys would go out there and go 6 minutes, 8 minutes, or whatever, which, I mean, and, I mean, and at times he told them, you know, get your match in, whatever you need, but if you... You know, I mean, if you don't want to go long, don't worry about it. I'll take it up and cover your time for you. And, I mean, he'd go 40 and 50 minutes. And, I mean, I seen him do that with Jerry Stubbs. And Jerry is a guy that I work with a lot in Continental, and he's one of the smoothest guys. I don't know if you know much about him, Mr. Olympia. He worked for
Bill Watson. Oh, he was tremendous. And he's one of the most underrated guys maybe ever.
Oh, I think so. I think him and you're fixing, I don't know if you've ever heard this or seen it, or but you can look after we or sometime when you got a free moment, look and see. One of my favorite tag teams when I was a kid, I went when my dad was working in Pensacola, when I was telling you about when he was training, when he was working with Scott Armstrong every night. I went down there for the summer and I saw Jerry Stubbs and Arn Anderson, which he wasn't Arn Anderson then he was Arn something, I don't know what they called it, but it wasn't Anderson. But I thought that was the greatest tag team. And still to this day, as far as them looking alike and being able to work and being smooth and everything, they was just, I mean, I watched their matches, and man, you talk about good.
Yeah, I mean, I think I've only seen a little bit of them as a team because there's not a lot of it on tape, but... I mean, Jerry Stubbs was the real deal. I mean, whether it was as Olympia or as himself, I mean...
Oh, well, right here's what he told me, and this is one thing that really, it gets over with me now, but then it scared the crap out of me. When I first started working with him, you know, I never opened my mouth. Well, one night he came in the dressing room, he said, kid, he said, it's time for me to shut up. And I looked at him, I said, do what? He said, it's time. He said, I ain't saying a word in the ring tonight. He said, you call this match. And I said, no, I said, I'll just listen to you. And he said, no, he said, I'm not going to open my mouth. He said, it's time for you to call this match. And from then on, and I mean, and like during his comeback and stuff, he would tell me what he was going to do or whatever. I mean, and we wouldn't talk about nothing in the pack. I mean, well, we'd talk, but I mean, we'd talk more like, you know, me and you're just talking back and forth now, not about wrestling, though. Everything, and he was such a good guy and so nice to me and everything. But I mean, like I said, and I was so young, and those guys had been working for so long then and everything. But Jerry was one of the smoothest, I mean, technicians that I'd seen. Like I said, when I was down there watching my dad and everything working, I saw him and Arn. I mean, I thought, man, if you can have a better tag team than this, I don't, you know, at that time, I hadn't saw it, which I mean, you know, like if I'd have been older, like my brother, I'm sure he saw tag teams that he thought the same thing about at that time, too. But, I mean, you talking about Jerry was just great, but you talking about having the crap scared out of you when he said, and I said, no, you just keep doing it. He said, no. He said, I've called these matches enough. He said, it's your time to start calling these matches. And I thought, and then after we got through that first one, and he said, no, there wasn't nothing to that, was it? I said, was it okay? And he said, yeah, it was good. And I thought, well, he's taught me just from working with him. He's taught me, and which I knew I was learning, but, you know, you don't want to, you know how intimidating, I mean, somebody that, and like you're saying that you always thought he was underrated and everything. I mean, how, you know, you don't want to go out there and with a guy that's been working for years and is as smooth as he was and is and everything, be trying to tell or that's me, you know, when you're a kid trying to say something to and tell them what to do or whatever. But that's, I mean, he showed me that was, and that's what he was wanting to show me was, you know, it ain't, I could call the match. If it wasn't with him, I could call the match. What he was saying, and that was his point.
So, almost time to finish up. Two last things I wanted to ask you about before we go, kind of more general open-ended questions. What basically, I'll ask them both and then you can answer however you want. Most fun you've ever had in wrestling, and also what do you think, like what What point of your career do you think was your peak as far as whether it was your best program or just putting everything together yourself? Like,
well, the what I look back at and love the most, I mean, is having the opportunity to be in tags with my brother and six mans with my brother and my dad against the top guys here, and like me and my brother against like Lawler and Ivan, Lawler Dundee, you have to call Sam Lawler and his son Brian. And as far as really top programs, which I work with Lawler a lot now, but as far as then I didn't, but as far as programs that I really liked, as far as we went for months and months, or I could say years with Brian Christopher Lawler. I mean, me and him worked every night against each other for about two and a half years. And I mean, and to work that long, you've got to have some ideas and some different things that is going on. And I mean, which we spice things up different ways, but that, and then the program that went on for about a year, year and a half with myself and Tommy Rich was my partner against PG-13, Jamie Dundee and Whoopi D. And I mean, cause that was when all the territories had shut down then except Memphis. And we was kind of, Lawler was going to, Lawler worked for Vince. So, I mean, his Monday nights was always up there. It wasn't ever in Memphis anymore. And so we had to try to carry the load. Now, we didn't draw a ton of money, but we kept the doors open and kept the territory going. So, I mean, I'll tell you something, in Louisville was like more of our, like from my age down crowd, in which cause, you know, Lawler didn't go up there as much as, you know, he wanted to make sure he was in Memphis. But I mean, when he went to Louisville, it meant something, but he didn't want to go that very often during those days and everything. And like I said, those two programs, me and Brian, I think that threw some money. Well, I know it threw some money. And then the program with me and Tommy against PG-13, that threw some money. And I really enjoyed and had a good time during those times. And, but like I said, anything with myself and my brother and my dad and everything at the Coliseum and seeing it, I mean, with people, but in it, like we had that Best of Memphis where it was a 10-man tag. It was myself, my brother, Terry Funk, Tommy Ridge, I'm trying to think who was, else was our partner. And then on the other side was Lawler, had Jimmy, Bill Dundee, Austin Idol, Brian Christopher. And, but I mean, when you consider that, and that's the last time it actually ever sold out.
And as far as most fun, would it be one of those, or would it maybe something else, like maybe even a specific moment or anything like that that you could think of?
Well, I'm going to tell you, and it was what I was saying before, and if and people pushes you, but you need to be pushed, and I learned that from my brother as far as getting people to work harder. But like working with my brother in Global, I love that. I worked with him in a program here in Memphis, and I love that because he could do such good promos and everything, and they had me doing a different thing one time, like Jerry had, that he wanted me to go to work for Vince as the King of Rock and Roll when Wayne Ferris had a falling out with him and everything, and I told him that my Japan deal was, you know, that was more, you know, I was worried about going up there and then it not working out, then, you know, if you mess your Japan stuff up, you're done with that for ever, basically, and everything. So I didn't do that. And but my program with Eddie here in Memphis, I really, that's something that was really high on my list. Like me working with him in Global, that was good. But like I said, he would push you. Like, I mean, there's a lot of guys I'm sure that will push you, but like I said, he was one that would sure push you. But all the things, I've got so many good times that there's not just one that I could say.
Yeah, and I was just thinking that, like, as far as with the best stuff, I mean, I had a feeling you might say the stuff with you and Tommy Rich against PG-13, because
Yeah, I mean, I love that, because we had a lot of input with Randy Hills, give us a lot of input on our stuff, which, I mean, he'd tell us what he wanted. And then he'd ask us what did we think, and did we want to add something to it, or take a little bit of something away from it, and everything. And
I mean, we had a good working relationship with Randy. He was real, I mean, as far as open on his stuff, which he had his ideas and what he wanted to do, but I mean, he would listen to you. But, and that's one thing I think a lot of people don't know about Eddie. I mean, Eddie had his ideas and what he wanted you to do, but like in the Continental Territory, like when the first program that was drawing money was the Dirty White Boy and Tom Pritchard. And then what Eddie did was build what I think, and when you're good, when you've got a good mind for the business, he brought guys in that had never, nobody had ever used, and they, I mean, and they'd been on WCW doing just jobs and stuff, and Eddie brought them in and gave them a gimmick and got them over and everything. I mean, when guys can do that, you are you do have a good mind for the business. I mean, and that's things that I think people don't look at when they look at Eddie's different tenures as booker at places and everything. I mean, he didn't have the best talent at all the places he had, at all the places he booked.
I mean, you're right. I mean, just thinking about, like you said, people who were jobbing WCW. I mean, Joey Maggs, and you, when he came to Memphis and did the heel turn, he became Joseph Magliano. I mean, I think people who only saw him in WCW would have no idea he had that in him.
Oh, no. No, and he did. And Joey worked hard, and he'd do anything that Eddie asked. But, I mean, it was and one of the prime examples, and there's a guy, his name's Alan Martin, that I mean,
yes.
He was a great guy, but, I mean, he just basically done jobs on WCW. But Eddie called him Mr. Martin in Continental and got him over a big heel and everything. But, I mean, when you can make guys like that, that shows that you do have a mind for business, and you know what's going on and what will draw money. And that's, I mean, you're doing the most with the least. I mean, that's the easiest way you can put it. When you don't have talent and you're making talent out of guys that, and I mean, I'm not saying that the guys wasn't talented, but what I'm saying is you didn't have the top talent guys and you still drew money with guys.
Right. It's not that they weren't talented, it's that they weren't stars.
Exactly. That's what I mean. I mean, it was nothing like, you're exactly right.
All right. So,
but I mean, basically, you can turn into stars. I'm sorry.
No, you can go ahead. I thought you were done for a second. Go ahead.
I am done. That's good. Go ahead.
Okay. So I'll edit that there. Just give me let me just see what the timestamp is on that. I guess that's about 106. Okay. Okay. Just give me 1 second, then I'll go into the end. All right, so I really want to thank you so much for coming on today. I think this turned out really, really well. And so to get into the plugs, so the weekend after this drops on Friday, April 17th, and Saturday, April 18th, Doug's going to be at PopCon in Evansville, which is actually promoted by someone that wrestling and MMA fans are going to be familiar with, which is Jeff Osborne. And he's got you, Lance Russell, Jerry Lawler, and I believe it's Jimmy Valiant and Bill Dundee.
Yeah, he's got us all there. I mean, it's the first time all of us guys will be together, and it's been quite a while and everything. And like I said, I'll be honest, I was with Lance Russell last night, and me and him was talking about it, and we were both talking about looking forward to seeing each other again next weekend and everything. And I mean, it'll be a great deal. And Jeff's a great guy. I don't know how many of you fellas know Jeff, but Jeff Osborne's a top-notch guy. I mean, he was a MMA, had a successful MMA company, and I mean, he does a little bit of everything, but I mean, he's a top-notch fella. But you'll have, like I said, Lance Russell, the King, myself, Handsome Jimmy, Bill Dundee. I mean, we'll all be there, and believe me, there's going to be a meet and greet, and we'll be signing and talking. There's going to be a Q&A and everything, so I'm sure I'll get asked a few questions about some lawsuits and about running over people and and everything else. But anyway, it should be an interesting evening, I would think. But listen, Dave, I appreciate you having me on your show and everything. Like I said, if anybody wants to keep up with what I've got going on and everything, which I told you about a few different things, which mm-hmm. I've got so many, I can't think of everything right now, but you can follow me at DangerousDG1 on Twitter and Instagram and everything, and I pretty much put everything that I've got going on there. But anyway, like I said, man, I appreciate you letting me be on here, and if there's anything we can help you out with in the future, don't hesitate to give me a shout.
Pleasure's all mine. And yeah, I'll have the links to everything, whether it's PopCon and some of the other stuff you told me about, in the show description. And Yeah, that's it. So, like to thank Doug for coming on and everyone for listening, and we'll be right back after this. All right, we're back. And, well, the plans changed. The original plan was that the second segment was going to be about half an hour with me and Patrick Lyman going over the UFC on Fox card for Newark this weekend. And, well, because it's such a good card, I think I'm very excited about being there live, and we went much longer than that, so we are going to post that as some kind of second part. I will have, I'm sure, in the description when exactly that'll be, because I probably should talk about that with Rich as far as it not disrupting the Voices of Wrestling feed. So, Patrick, say hi so people know that I'm not recording this myself.
No, you are not recording this yourself. I am, in fact, here.
Yes. So that will be up at some point after this first part, obviously before Saturday. I don't want to just throw them both together in the feed because I know for some people that could screw things up depending on what their podcast app is, if it just downloads the most recent episode. So, yeah. So thankfully, though, for the people who are not into UFC, just skip that episode. So otherwise, just going to sign off here. That's it for this week. We will be back next week if you're only into the wrestling stuff. Otherwise, stay tuned within the next day or so for the UFC preview special thing, which also I'll be live tweeting on the Wrestling Observer Twitter, which is at WONF4W. Lovely. I'm just trying to record this little short thing and even I screw up something there. Yes, at WONF4W, probably also on my own Twitter, at David Bix. And, well, Patrick's getting into watching more wrestling, so I'm sure I can convince him to tweet about something wacky and follow him at Patrick_Wyman. And I hope everyone enjoyed the Doug Gilbert interview. And yeah, I guess that's it. Everyone, take care. Until next time, that's The Big Show. Fix.